Accession number 13586, Reel 1.
You remember, James, that in July last, before we visited any of the battlefields, we ought to see the original site of a battlefield at Beaumont Hamel, which was captured by the Highland Division in November 1916. Now, in the Memorial Park, you remember, there was a large area of about 800 yards by 1,000 yards, sloping from west to east. The east, the Germans were in the east, of course. And it was bordered by a steep ravine. That was the site of the German front line. And if you remember, the British line was still there, visible to us, and the support line, and clearly marked. The ground was pitted with shell holes, as all battlefields were. But, of course, time had taken over, and grass had grown in all these. But the grass was kept down by the sheep we saw there. Now, we saw amongst the shell holes lots of bits of barbed wire. You also saw, sadly, three cemeteries and two war memorials. But when you saw that picture, you saw this place on the ground, you would begin to realize how small an area a man was aware of. You were in a little field about the distance I've quoted, and you were tied down with a section of men or a platoon of men, and you usually didn't know what was happening on your right or left. You were being shelled. It was raining. It always was. Somebody wounded would be calling out. But if you could put that into your mind, you've then got a picture of what the battlefield was like. The rain, the mud, and the fear. Well, the fear is hard to describe. It's a state of mind which means I'm here, I've got to stay here, and I've got to fight here, without any heroics. It was just one of the things you had to put up with. It was war. It was all.
When you first went out to the battlefield, so what was your first impression of the trenches?
Well, the first trenches I was in weren't really trenches, James. They were, what do I call them? They were
sangars. Really.
They were breastworks. They were composed mostly of faggots of wood and filled in with earth behind them and sandbags on top and a fire step manufactured the same sort of way. These were brought up by the engineers to our dump at night and put up. And they were open at the back, no protection from shell bursts. They were in a wood, which you saw. You were in sanctuary wood. And it was just as we saw it in July. The trees were in full bloom. It had only been occupied for about 3 days by my battalion at that time. They had been pushed back from the far side of the wood, which I saw with you for the first time in my life, on the east side of the wood, when we were there. I'd never seen that side. That was the German side.
Did they have dugouts in these?
There were no dugouts in those at all.
So where did you sleep?
We slept on the fire step. You wrapped your waterproof sheet around you, and you lay on the fire step. You slept, you dozed. You never had a sleep. You were having a cat's nap. But you were there. We were there for 24 days, right off. We only moved from support front line to support line, which was about 100 yards further back, the edge of the woods, where we actually had our picnic. That was our support line. And the battalion headquarters was just about another 100 yards down the road. There was no road there then. That road to the way out. Was where the dump was, the medical post, the RPO, Regimental Aid Post, the RAP, and that's where the wounded were dealt with. And there in Sanctuary Wood, where the cemetery was, I helped bury one of my friends who was killed there.
And so did all your cooking and...
Ah, yes. Cooking, the funniest thing about cooking was we didn't have the solidified alcohol fuel tablets which were used later in the war, which I got later in 1917. We used a little cigarette tin full of rifle oil, and we put a bit of a rifle 4x2 and flannelette, dipped it in, and set it off with a match. It created a small flame, and it took 2 hours to make a mess tin of water hot, not boiling ever, but just hot. And in that, you made tea, half-boiled tea, or you made pea soup, which was the thing we used mostly. And you were drumming up, they call that, all the time. It was the only thing you could do when you weren't sitting watching on duty or anything. You were somebody was always drumming up.
Was tea then part of your army rations?
Oh, yes.
That was from home?
No, no. We got a good ration of tea. The army was very good for tea. And men were always getting stuff from home as well at that time of the war. Because I had, when we came out of Ypres, out of Sanctuary Wood, I had about 6 parcels of food waiting for me, but it was half of them, the scones and cakes my mother had made, were all rotten by that time, but the tins were all right. That was a great thing.
How about washing?
Well, we had we used tins, which had been rationed tins, which we used to get of water, and a canvas bucket. And there was a little stream running through the wood. I think I showed you where it was. And we had created a little system of filterage by charcoal, which had been sent up for us to light our fires with to cook. We weren't allowed to cook in the front line, but everybody ignored that. Because we had to have some heat, and the only way to do it was to cut up wood we got, ammunition boxes, or even dry sticks, to very fine, like a match, and sit and spend our whole time when we weren't on duty trying to get warm by cooking. That's what it was.
So can you then describe your typical day?
Well, first of all, the important thing was you had to be on duty. There was always 2 sentries on by night and 1 sentry by day in each little post. A post would be about 10 yards long of this embankment thing you had as a so-called trench. The day would be spent by doing a watch on and watches off, two hours on and 2 hours or 4 hours off. But the object of the exercise was to keep the Germans from advancing by round our flanks and get round behind us. All the sections were watching. We had to keep contact to, as a platoon sergeant, I had to go along to the various sections. There were 4 or 5 section posts in all. There were 4 sections then. I spent my time going between the sections. The platoon commander, who was killed the first hour I was with him in the front line, was succeeded by the then platoon sergeant, Tam Yates, a great friend of mine, and I became platoon sergeant. But our day was usually filled up by repairing damage to the breastworks. Especially sandbags would be hit with bits of shell. The shells were hitting nearly the whole time for the weeks we were in that wood. Every day there was constant, and every night, constant noise of bullets hitting with a very smart thud into the trees. And that was very frightening.
Were they dangerous as far as you were concerned? I mean,
well, everyone, you always knew that the one you had heard was past you. You never would hear the one was going to hit you. So the bullets were flying high, because that wood, as you remember, was on the reverse slope. You see, the Germans were up the hill from us, and the bullets couldn't get down to the ground. But nevertheless, a lot of people were killed by shell fire. In fact, in that company, they lost 8 sergeants in 8 days. I was the 9th sergeant to come when I joined, and I was a bit scared when I was told this. But the day was, you were watching on, you were keeping your, always every morning, of course, you had to clean your, make sure your rifle was, and your ammunition was all right. That was after you stood down. The first thing was to clean your rifle and one by one, not all together. And give yourself a wash out of some dirty water. And usually about 12 men could wash out 1 tin of water, I tell you that. And shave, yes, but I didn't need to shave in those days. I was only 19 or 20. And I shaved about once a fortnight. But men who required to shave always did shave. There wasn't much time spent in washing. But in the rations, the great time came, of course, when we collected the rations at night. And also, of course, we had people on patrol going out in the wood in advance of where we were at night as a listening patrol. They were to lie there and wait to hear the enemy advancing. Now, we had a day attack, it so happened. I'll tell them later on. But not at that, when I went into the place first. First of all, I was in there, surrounded by noise, bursting shells, and constant machine gun fire. And I was very, very scared, and most people were. But the day was, it seemed to be never ending. And then when it came to night, we did get a little bit of sleep, a little bit of rest, when we were standing there waiting for going on sentry go.
But was there much movement?
Well, In the first week in the front line, we remained in we didn't lose any part of our trenches. But in the second week, we were moved to the left flank to support the Gloucesters, who were on our left. And one morning, their platoon commander came along to our platoon commander and said that his people had lost a trench. In other words, an embankment like we'd had, a breastwork like we'd had. And he was going to take it back. But he only had about 15 men, and we were about 25 strong. And he asked for help. And my platoon sergeant said, that was my platoon commander, Tam Yates, saw the company commander, Jimmy Ferguson, who was killed in High Wood a year later. And he came forward with us, and we advanced through the wood. And there was no wire then, very little wire. We were able to go through, but the broken branches, broken trees, made our advance very difficult. And we got into the enemy trench, and they got out of it quickly. And then we put the Gloucesters back and then went back to where we were. So that was the first, we actually saw the Germans face to face.
So really, you didn't see the Germans much, you didn't sort of advance out of your trenches?
Not in Sanctuary Wood. The object of the exercise was to hold the wood, not to advance from it, because we weren't strong enough. We only had, we had four companies in the front line out of four companies. I'm wrong in that. We had three companies in the front line, one in reserve. That meant we had very few men to support anybody. Any part of the front line had gone. We had no reserves at all to recapture it. That's why we'd helped the Gloucesters.
What was your uniform?
We wore a kilt and a kilt apron, full equipment, web equipment, and 120 rounds of ammunition. We had no gas helmets, because the gas attack had only occurred about a fortnight before we got there. But we had got a small pad of cotton wool, which we were supposed to soak in urine and put round your mouth to protect you against the effects of chlorine gas, which, as I said, was the first latest horror. The uniform, we had our packs with us, and we took the pack off and kept it at our place in the trench. We could sit on it and so on, but we kept our pouches and water bottle and entrenching tool with us, and the haversack, the small haversack in which we had our shaving things, that's all. But we had our waterproof sheets. We had, in fact, we went in with our greatcoats on that particular time, and we took them off in the trench in the daytime, put them on at night. But of course, many of the greatcoats were lost, bound to be covered with shell, but everybody managed to get one of some sort to get cover at night. You had the rain, you had your raincoat, you had your sheet, your waterproof sheet, and you had your greatcoat. And of course, you pulled up your hoat tops over your knees because you were pretty cold, mm-hmm. sitting there
Did
in a
you
kilt.
You managed to keep warm.
Yes, well, we were young, you see. All the people were young. You see, I was 20, and all the people were young. The oldest man, I think, was Tam Yates, who was about 35. He was an old man. He was 35. So you can just imagine what it was like. We were all volunteers. Another point, James. There was we had no steel helmets, and we had no gas masks, and we had no special training in sniping and things of that sort, which were necessary later on. But it was, to be in action was, to me, something wonderful, because I'd been brought up against an army background, and I knew of people who had fought in the South African War and spoken to many of them. And the whole story of the friends of my father's were all in the army, and they all talked about action. You know, how they happened at the Atbara with the Camerons and the Seaforce, and what happened in South Africa at Elonslachty when the Highland Brigade was decimated. All these sort of things were just what I had been brought up on. And of course I came to the same sort of thing myself in Sanctuary Wood.
Was that why you joined the army?
I joined it when I was a schoolboy. I joined as a drummer boy in the Dandy Ninth, the Ninth Royal Scots. I was still at school, and I was in March 1910, and King Edward the Seventh was on the throne, and he died in May of that year. So I served the crown under in a number of reigns, Edward VII, George V, George VI, Edward VIII, and the present Queen.
But you didn't have to go abroad.
No.
It was your choice?
It was my own choice. We all had the option. When we were called up as Territorials in August 1914, I've still got my embodiment notice. We were asked if we would volunteer for overseas service, because the Territorials were based on home defence. And a great many of us volunteered, and we had a little badge called Imperial Service, which we wore on the left-hand pockets of our tunics. That was soon taken away. It eventually disappeared. But all those people who took part in the war up to 1916 had been volunteers. And that, of course, makes a great difference when you're dealing with men. And in my company and in my battalion, the 9th Royal Scots, a great many men were men like myself. They'd been undergraduates at the university, or young insurance men, or young bankers. All men of intelligence, bright young men, I hope they were. But a great many of them died there.
Were you ever able to get back to England on leave, or was leave taken in France?
Leave was supposed to be once in 6 months for people in the ranks, and the officers might be 4 or 5 months, depended on the number of vacancies allotted. And of course, while battles were on, all leave was stopped. I got my first leave in November, and I arrived home in November 1915 on the Lord Mayor's show day, and saw it in London for the first time. And I was wearing my kilt and my Balmoral bonnet, which we had then, not a Glengarry, and a goatskin coat, which was a form of protection for the winter, which had been issued. It became a leather jerkin, followed it soon afterwards. So I had a goatskin coat, which of course were filthy when they got laid down in mud, and it wasn't so good as the leather jerkins, which were in use for till the rest of the war, which was a sort of waistcoat, a long waistcoat of tanned leather, which was very warm, lined with blanket stuff. You never see them nowadays.
But what kind of guns did you have then?
Well, we went out actually with a long Lee Enfield rifle, which had been used in the South African War, but it was modified to carry what was known as Mark 6 ammunition, which meant that the battalion, when I joined it, had all the short Lee Enfield rifle. And very quickly in Sanctuary Wood, I found, picked up from some wounded man or discarded it, short Lee Enfield rifle, which I kept for the rest of the war, because it had actually on its butt the Gloucester's regimental number and the number of the rifle. That was the practice. There was a little butt brass stud on the butt, which gave the battalion and the regiment and the number in the arms book. And I had that rifle right till I was commissioned.
You said in reading your memoirs that you're able in certain places to buy food in the towns. And how often were you able to do that?
Well, it depended on what towns we were near. At Sanctuary Wood, and coming out of Sanctuary Wood, we went back to Renninghurst. There was no possibility of buying food at all anywhere around the Ypres area. We were too far away from any town. There was a place called Poppering where we went in for a bath when we first came out, but not for food. But in Armentières, which was our next place to be in the trenches, there again were proper breastworks we had, lovely trenches. We had to sweep them out every morning. The reason was that the water table in that district was only a foot underground, and if you went down a foot, you were in water. So you had to build the trenches up. They'd been built the previous winter by the 19th Infantry Brigade, a very famous brigade, and they had constructed wonderful breastwork. They were about 7 foot high and about 15 to 20 feet thick, with a big wall behind the trench, a parado it's called, which defended you from the back blast of any shell that went over. Now, those trenches were spotlessly clean. We used to put whitewash round them, and latrines were provided, because in ordinary trenches you would have to find a little alleyway which you mark a latrine and dig a hole, and that's that. But in the Daily Mirror trenches, they call these in Armentières, nobody was allowed to do that sort of thing. The latrine was properly kept and cleaned up by the pioneers, whose job it was, and it was plenty of chloride of lime was laid about. And the trenches were very good, and you could never got wet in them. You could stand on the fire step and look over, and you could see all. They were continuous. For the first time, we had a continuous line. You saw the German trenches about 100 yards to 200 yards away, and in between was usually a lot of ploughed field and a lot of poppies growing, and that was about May or June. And that was then, of course, every inch of the front line was held by soldiers, which was a great contrast to what happened later on. So if anyone's open fire, rapid fire on your left or right, you at once stood to, and everybody got up and started to fire like blazes at the enemy trenches. Well, that was a great waste of ammunition, but pretty good for the morale.
But what were the dugouts like in
placements? In these breastworks, we did have dugouts in the rear of the trench. They were supported. They could, in fact, take the shock of a light shell, but not anything heavy. No heavy shell would withstand. Too big a heavy construction required to be safe. They weren't safe. You were forbidden, in fact, to dig under a front line trench, even later on in the war, because the concussion of the shell on the parapet of the trench would cause the soldier in the dugout below it to be buried and lost.
So you didn't have any in the front line?
Not at that stage of the war, not in 1915. But in 1917 we had one or two on Greenland Hill, which the Germans had made. When we took them over from the Germans, we found them pretty strong spelling by that time. Especially the German dead had been left in some of them.
In another part of the memoirs, you had referred to Tunnel Trench.
Ah!
What was that like?
Tunnel Trench was a wonderful trench. The trouble about Tunnel Trench was too good. The people who were getting war-weary were too anxious to stay below, undercover. It was 30 foot deep down, and you saw the place where the trench was. We were on that ridge that we walked, where you nearly found. We picked up the Mills bomb, the unexploded one, and you picked up the Stoke shell. Now, that ridge, as you saw, on your left, as we went along the ridge, facing the... On our left was the enemy trench in that hollow, and about 200 yards away from the top of the ridge. Now, the tunnel trench was just on that ridge, down below, 30 foot down, and they made by the Germans before the Germans had fallen back to that line. And they were inside, there were a continuous line of trench. It was a continuous trench for several miles, down below. And off the main alleyway, as it were room for bunks for people. And you could have company headquarters and things like that, all along, and lit by electric light. And although the trench was blown in at one end by the Germans, they didn't destroy the electricity, and we were getting our lights free of any cost from the Germans. They had the lights on. But the trouble about those, you had a 30-foot entrance. You had to climb down steps, down 30 foot. Now, once soldiers who were frightened by shell fire, there were a lot of young soldiers by that time, they were apt to get down there at the slightest cause, at the slightest, any incident happening, they would disappear down the trench. And it's up to the NCOs to make sure they stayed up on the front line, not going down the dugouts.
That was the main line.
The front line was nominally about 200 yards down the hill. But in 1917-18, that winter, it was so wet and snow that my front line, I was a company commander then, I was commanding D Company, it was flooded. And I evacuated my front line and pulled all the people back to Tunnel Trench, where we were very able to have our tea and comfort.
Tunnel Trench, you were very susceptible to attack.
Well, Tunnel Trench was the second line of defense, really. The Germans had to get through the wire, and then they had to cross the quagmire, which was my front line at that stage. It was full to the top of water, and they would fall into it. It was a 6 foot deep trench. And then they'd come up through the shell holes to where we were. So when the Germans did attack, we got out of the front line and got out of the tunnel trench and went in front of it and were able to fire from the shell holes. And so when the shell fire came onto our front line, onto what we call the front line, tunnel trench was really the front line, we weren't affected. And we saved ourselves casualties by doing that. But tunnel trench was a delusion and a snare for people who were inexperienced. For the old soldier, my side was keep out of it except for food. Go upstairs. That's the only way to get round the difficulty. There were men in all ranks and in all regiments who were known as dugout conscious, who were, especially some company commanders who had been out too long. They would go into the dugout and they'd stay there and command the men from there. Well, that's no way to command troops. You've got to be with the men. You've got to be alongside them, be visibly with them, talking to them, And all the time you did that, you had to keep, you had to know all your soldiers, and you had to keep them cheerful, no matter how uncheerful the conditions were. That was the art of it. That's what leadership's all about, as you must know.
So did the Germans actually at any time break through tunnels then?
Well, they did, and that was on the 21st of March 1918, which was then the blackest day of the British Army. In the morning, that morning, it was misty, and I was commanding a company in the front line on tunnel trench, the place you saw, the place, in fact, where you saw the bombs. And we stood to up to 9 o'clock in the morning. That meant we had shell fire, a great deal of shell fire, heavy shell fire, bombardments, to our left and right, but not on our trench. And we stood too. That means we went, every man was standing at the trench ready in a position to fire if he saw the enemy. But it was misty and we didn't see any enemy. And so we stood down at 9 o'clock. I took responsibility of saying so. We said, stand there and get rest. We may be in action a little later. Well, a little later, in fact, about within the hour, the mist lifted just in front of us, down in the place where the field opposite the top of the ridge, where I pointed out to you from the water tower, we looked down. I got a call from my company sergeant major, sir, so I went up from the dugout and said, there they are, oh, right, stand to, or out of the trench, into the shell holes on the other side. And then we saw the Germans coming in line, coming down in odd lots, probably about 50 to 60 of them opposite us.
In a block?
And they were about, yes, in a line, but two or three deep, you see, and they were about 200 yards away. So we opened fire. Everybody, oh, easy, we could see them, but the mist was made very indistinct. They got distinct as they came nearer. They got to within about 100 yards, and they got to where our own front line was, in fact. And they had to get into this mess of water and things. And then, of course, we managed to get them. They just fell down, never saw them again. But another lot started to come over, and then another lot. Then suddenly behind us we heard the explosion of what we called the Granatenwerfer. That's a pineapple bomb fired from water. It's got a high pitched noise, and it's a very destructive little weapon. It's a very small weapon, only the size of a pineapple, the actual bomb. And we knew we were being bombed, but from another side. And but this thing went on all the morning till about 1 o'clock. Suddenly, standing to, and Germans appearing, and a shell fire on either side of us, and then the Germans disappearing. And the soldier, believe me, when he's in a position of danger of that sort, is not a quiet man. None of my jocks were. They were cussing and they were swearing and they were, getting rid of the relieving of their feelings, inviting the so-and-sos to come on and firing at them and saying, that's a good shot, I got four of the so-and-sos. From that point of view, it was very stimulating. And, of course, a good thing, because they'd forget to be frightened. And I saw one machine gunner, my Lewis gunner, was hit. So I took his Lewis gunner, I was a Lewis gun instructor at one stage. And I had a couple of drums off at one of them. I don't know how many I hit, but I certainly had a go at them. Mm. And then in one of the lulls, I was going along, not over the top, back into the trench, to find out what was happening, when this company sergeant major, Bill Lindsay, came to me and said, sir, they're not in touch on the right. So I went along with him, and we found there was an empty trench and no sign of any enemy. So I said, we'll make a bomb block, which means you pull the sandbags down and get a clear view for about 40 feet so that your fellow can't throw a bomb at you, and establish several soldiers, put a post there. And then as we turned away, having made secure our right flank, as we thought, one of the young officers, one of my subalterns, came along and said, oh, we're out of touch on the left, sir. Nobody on our left, which was down on the road, you know, where it came from Fontaine-le-Courcil, that road down where we left the car. He said, there's nobody on the left. So we put another bomb block there. And then, I said, thinking, well, what's happening now? We were out of touch. The telephone lines had all been bombed and torn up, so they weren't able to get in touch by telephone. Couldn't see the company headquarters, which was in the quarry, as you know, over the top. We couldn't see the quarry. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering what to do when the sergeant major, who was with me, said, sir, he said, German helmets behind us. So in the trench, which was the support trench for us, there were German helmets about 100 yards to the right of where you found the bomb. So there was another trench there, which had been a forward trench in the days of the Germans, when the Germans had held it, and Tunnel Trench was their support trench. He said, the Germans are there. So I said, this is the moment of truth. We'll have to get out of here quickly. Because we were an isolated company of about 80 men, holding about 300 yards of front. And we'd been there all from morning. We had no knowledge of what's happening on our right or left. And it's a matter for the man on the spot to decide what to do. Were we to stay there till all our ammunition was exhausted, or should we just pack up and go back to battalion headquarters and fight another day? So quickly we got the word round, rendezvous in the quarry. Everybody knew the quarry, 800 yards to the rear. And I gave a whistle and a signal, and I was in the middle, and I was about the first over that over that parapet I show you, the parado over the back, and bolting like mad down towards the quarry. There was all fields of grain, as you saw. Well, it was plain, this plain uncultivated ground then, and a lot of shell holes on it. But I was going fast, and I didn't mind that, because I knew that I should be able to rally them all when I got down there. I was amongst the first four. Anyhow, I turned into the quarry on the road, which is blocked up now, but you saw where the place was. And I turned in to the left suddenly at the quarry. It was 800 yards away, and I was in good trim because I wasn't out of breath. And there, to my horror, my hair on the back of my neck stood up. I saw German guns, artillerymen, horses, Germans, in battalion headquarters, in the quarry.